So do you know what teleology is?
No. I swear to me,
It's the study of the last things. So this is the last things. This is the end of... There'll be seven more lectures. Or is it... Yeah, six or seven. So today we talk about chapter 17, try to finish that up. The Friday and Monday we'll talk about topics from chapters 18 and 19 about acid derivatives and condensations, which we've already previewed pretty well. And then we'll maybe finish that up and on Wednesday and do a little bit of introduction to carbohydrates, so that on Friday next, Professor Ziegler, who is a real synthetic chemist, will come and talk to you. But what he's going to talk to you about is how Emil Fischer proved what the configuration of glucose was, which we've alluded to before, but he's going to get the opportunity to tell you about it. That's the last day of normal classes. If he doesn't quite get done, he likes to talk about this. He has a lot of interesting stuff. And if he's willing and you're willing, he could talk about it a little more on Monday. I don't know. I'll be back on Wednesday and we'll do two review sessions, but they're really material about first the synthesis of an unnatural product, which is how to make cyclobutadiene so you can study it, and it's made inside a molecule like a ship in a bottle so that it can't react with anything else. So that's a sort of an interesting synthesis, but mainly it'll be a review of all the topics we've talked about in the context of how to make that stuff. And then on Friday in reading period, we'll do another sort of review which talks about the synthesis of a natural product, R.B. Woodward's synthesis of cortisone. So that's what's from here on in. So today we're talking about chapter 17, but in the context, as we started last time, of or at least a few of the topics will have to do with this stuff about green chemistry. Now, in particular, we noted that one of the top vote getters in this effort of big pharma companies to say what they'd like researchers to do better for them is to develop a safer and more environmentally friendly Mitsunobu reaction. Now, for this purpose, it'd be interesting to see what the Mitsunobu reaction is, and I'm no expert on it. I've never done a Mitsunobu reaction. But actually, it's a subclass of OH activation for nucleophilic substitution. So we're going to spend a little time at the beginning of the class looking at the Mitsunobu reaction. So there's Oyo Mitsunobu, who died 7 years ago, who invented this reaction. And the fundamental idea of it is to make this derivative of an alcohol that has a phosphorus cation associated with three phenyls on it. Then if you bring in a nucleophile, it turns out that's just a great leaving group. Okay, so it's a way to activate OH for substitution. Okay. Now, it has some special virtues. It's very general for nucleophiles whose conjugate acid has a pKa of less than 15. So you can do it with carboxylates, that is you'd make esters, or you can make phosphorus esters, phosphate esters. You can make imides with nitrogen. You can make N3 derivatives of R, which don't sound at first glance very useful, but in fact they're very important synthetic intermediates. For one thing, they can be used to make amines. And the one I'm going to illustrate is active, what are called active methylene compounds. Now, that means here's from Mitsunobu's big paper describing this in, I think it was 19, it's under the time clock there, I forget, 1985 maybe. But he's talking about making optically active methyl succinic acid. So he starts with this stuff here, and this is what's called an active methylene compound. What would make that CH2 group different from just generic CH2s, say an octane or something like that. Anybody got an idea why that might be called active? Yeah.
There's an ester on one side of it and a nitrogen on the other side.
Right. So there's a triple bond of nitrogen here, so it's sort of an alpha to that, and it's electron withdrawing and an ester here. So what kind of reaction would you expect to happen here?
A nucleophilic, or that's an electrophile, so a nucleophile.
Yeah, what it'll do is lose a proton. The enolate anion will be very stable. It'll be enolic both on this side. That'll stabilize the anion, the pi star, and also the pi star here will stabilize the anion. So it's easy to lose a proton, and what it's got a pKa of 13. And once you've done that, then you have this enolate nucleophile. So it's a carbon nucleophile, carbon anion, that can do nucleophilic substitution. Okay, so that's what they mean by active methylene compounds. Okay, now, so that's our nucleophile. It's going to make a carbon-carbon bond when it attacks this R. So here's the alcohol that we want to activate. So it's made into a thing like this, and we'll talk about that in a second. And then the SN2 reaction happens. This attacks, and it gives an inversion of configuration. Notice it says, incidentally, that the product was isolated by preparative layer chromatography in a yield of 61%. That's not your favorite way to isolate and purify things. Crystallization or distillation or something is much more convenient, but they had to do it by layer chromatography. But the optical purity was greater than 99%. So this really does inversion. That's one of the big advantages of the Mitsunobu reaction. It's for secondary alcohols. It does a really good job of giving high yield in inversion, even though in this case the overall yield was only 61%. Often it's higher than that. Okay, so this carbon is inverted, it says. But wait a second. This carbon is also optically active, right, a chiral center. And that one, which comes from here, you should be able to attack that anion from either side. So there should be epimers, that means diastereomers, that differ at only one center. Since they're different diastereomers, you wouldn't expect them to be formed in identical yields, right? But you'd worry about having both. Wasn't that a trouble when he was trying to do this reaction? Well, it wasn't, for reasons that you'll see here. That he recrystallized the product. Notice, so this is another thing I wanted to say. He recrystallized the ultimate product in a yield of 502 milligrams, or 29%. So now you worry about this 99% stereochemical purity. Did the reaction really do that? Or, when he did the crystallization, did he crystallize just the one enantiomer and the other one stayed away? Okay, that's what you worry about when you see a description like this, when the product was ultimately recrystallized and the yield, overall yield, was low. But what he's talking about there is something else. Notice he hydrolyzed this product, right, with concentrated hydrochloric acid. So what's going to hydrolyze in this molecule? What's going to react with water in acid? We already talked about what functional group would you say this has here and here? It's got esters. Acid, water, ester. What do you think? Yeah?
You get
okay. Yeah, Victor?
Protonate.
Pardon me?
You can protonate the carbonyl.
Yeah, you protonate the carbonyl, put water on the carbonyl, take the alcohol off the carbonyl, and you have an acid. So this is Fischer esterification backwards. Take the ester and go if you have an excess of water. Okay, so you're going to take that ester, is going to become an acid, and that ester will become an acid. But notice that he said it was not only treated with hydrochloric acid, it was refluxed for 16 hours. Right? You don't need that to do the to do the Fisher esterification. The reason he did that was this CN triple bond is itself related to acids. This carbon has the same oxidation level as the carbon in an acid, three bonds to more electronegative element, nitrogen in this case. So hydrolysis can convert that CN, the nitrile, into itself an acid, but that's a much harder reaction to do. So that's why he had to heat it so long. Okay, but now what do you notice here? What difference did that make here? About stereochemistry. Richard? It's not a stereo center anymore, so you didn't care, right? You probably got a mixture of those two originally, but once he's going toward the product, it does that. And in fact, it does another thing, which is also in the subject of chapter 17, which is acids like that where you have two carboxylic acids on the same carbon lose CO2. So the H comes in here. And in fact, the ultimate product is this, the stuff he was trying to make, right? And that's, so he got a high optical purity of that, right? Now, this particular experiment doesn't prove that this gives high optical purity because of this recrystallization at the end, right? But in fact, that's one of the principal virtues of this Mitsunobu procedure, is its ability to give clean inversion of configuration. So that it allows correcting synthetic mistakes. Now, it could be that you designed the synthesis wrong and got the wrong stereochemistry at a particular center, or maybe you designed it right and got the wrong stereochemistry at some center, but you want to change, the part of your plan was then to change it. And the Mitsunobu procedure allows you to do that, and it's widely used by synthetic chemists. So, suppose you made this alcohol, and they've done it with really, really complicated things that have an alcohol in them, and that it's got the S configuration, but what you want is the R configuration. Right? So what you do is a Mitsunobu reaction, and the nucleophile is acetate. So it comes in and displaces with clean inversion the OH, or in fact this group. Right? So it gives the R configuration of this, but then that's an ester which can easily be hydrolyzed by base, and we'll talk about that a little more. So now you have the R alcohol. So you can take one alcohol and cleanly make it into the other one by this procedure, and it's a very widely used way to do that. Okay, now, but the only question is, you need these reagents 1 and 2 in order to do this. Right? What are those reagents that allow you to generate this intermediate? Okay? So this is the mechanism of the Mitsunobu reaction. You start with triphenylphosphine, that's going to become this part, and water, the alcohol, which is going to give you the OR, but there's a problem here. Can you see what it is? When you look at this, you notice that the phosphorus at the top is -3 in its oxidation level. Right? But the phosphorus here is -1 because it's got that oxygen and the plus charge. Right? So what do you infer? What kind of reagent are you going to look for? Yeah?
Oxidizing.
You're going to need an oxidizing agent to do this. Okay? Now, the oxidizing agent that's used in the Mitsunobu procedure is a very unusual oxidizing agent. This thing which is diethyl azo dicarboxylate. It's abbreviated DEAD, D-E-A-D, right? In fact, it's sometimes used with isopropyl groups here more recently, and then it's D-I-A-D, but DEAD is maybe more memorable. Okay, so it's interesting because in this rather complicated procedure, there are three different nucleophiles. They're all present there, and each one's got to attack the right thing. So it has to be tuned just right. Okay? Now, part of it probably is relatively easy because the first reaction is for this phosphorus with its unshared pair to attack the nitrogen-nitrogen double bond. So that's a little bit like a carbonyl double bond. And furthermore, what's good about putting the electrons on there to make that nitrogen an anion? Why? carbonyl next door. Okay, so you come down here, the phosphorus is attacked. Here's the nitrogen anion stabilized by the carbonyl. So that looks good. And the first thing I think you do when you do these, at least in that procedure I just showed you, is mix these two things. Right, so now this, now you form that. So that nucleophile's okay. You don't have to worry about it participating later on. Okay, then they add HX, the thing that's where X is the nucleophile you're going to want, like a carboxylic acid, for example. Okay, so it protonates the nitrogen here, the enolate type anion. Okay. And now you bring in the second nucleophile, the alcohol that you want to make into this thing with the leaving group. Okay? So it comes in and attacks the phosphorus. Right? And then this nitrogen is a leaving group because it's an electronegative atom, or sort of electronegative, but it's also like an enolate, so it's not bad as a leaving group, and it gets protonated to give this. So that's, there's a bond here between two of those, right? So that's got H's on the two ends that didn't have H's up here. So that's been reduced. That was the oxidizing agent by this complicated mechanism. Okay, so you've got this. And now you have the thing you want. And it's a good leaving group, as we said over here. So that's how the reaction works with this very unusual oxidizing agent. So it's a nucleophilic substitution, but it's done with both oxidizing and reducing. Right? So that's interesting in that mechanistically. Now, what's not so great about it from the point of view of green chemistry is that it's very what's called atom inefficient, because the goal is to remove H2O, H from X. And OH from the alcohol to put the R on the X on the R, right? So what you're working to do is get out something that has a molecular weight of 18, but you've generated byproducts that are that this triphenylphosphine oxide and this reduced stuff that's 450 molecular weight. So you got all this junk you got to get rid of. And furthermore, it's separable, as we saw on that previous slide, only by chromatography. So it's really tough to do this. So if you could do this very reliable reaction in a cleaner way, that would be something that the pharmaceutical people think would be hot stuff, right? There's one approach that's been made to help remove this compound, which is to have the triphenylphosphine attached to a polymer chain, right? Which is a bead. And then all you have to do is wash stuff away from the bead. So you don't have to separate this molecule by molecule. So the chromatography is not as important. So there's work being done on improving that. But that's what this Mitsunobu reaction is. Okay, now some things from the book just to highlight what's especially worth looking at in this chapter. So on page 836 here, there's some stuff about acidity of substituted carboxylic acids. And you remember 4.5 is the pKa of a generic carboxylic acid like acetic. But if you start putting chloro groups on it, it becomes more and more acidic. And you can see, fluorine is even a little better than chlorine, and trifluoroacetic acid is quite a strong acid. It's got a negative pKa. And other electronegative groups also make it a stronger acid. So if you look here, there's butanoic acid. 4-chloro, where the chlorine's quite far away, is only very marginally more acidic. Right? But if you put the chlorine in the 3 position, it's still more, and the chlorine in the alpha position, still much more acidic. So that's what we've seen before, that these inductive effects of stabilizing anions, of course, fall off with distance. That's not a big deal, but it's just, it's important, but you knew it already. Okay, then ways to make carboxylic acids by oxidation and reduction. We've talked about some of these before. So you can oxidize an alcohol to make an acid. You can oxidize an aldehyde to make an acid. And often this aldehyde is an intermediate in the going from the alcohol to the acid. Okay, so then here's some specific examples. We talked about chromic acid. Permanganate also does the trick. We've talked about ozone as an oxidizing agent to cleave a bond. And this, remember, was worked up with hydrogen peroxide, so it went all the way to the acid. If you put in zinc or some reducing agent to get rid of the hydrogen peroxide, you'll remember from when we were talking about alkenes, then you can get the aldehyde. Here's an example with ozone. Here's something a little bit different, which is to use a strong oxidizing agent to take an alkyl side chain off of benzene and make it into a carboxylic acid. Here's an example of that. So those are not anything very new. Here's another oxidation of a double bond to give a carboxylic acid. But you can also do reductions to give carboxylic acids, which we haven't talked about before. So here in section 17.6b, you can see that you can use CO2 and reduce. CO2 has a carbon oxidation level of 4. Plus 4, but you can make it into a carboxylic acid oxidation state 3 by using a Grignard, which can be thought of in this case as an oxidizing agent. So R minus attacks the carbonyl, you get this, protonate the carboxylic acid, and you have it. So you've added CO2 to a carbon anion. That's another way to make an acid, and here's a specific example of that. Okay. That's 17.6. And then ways to make esters reacting, breaking the OH bond. You could either break we've talked already about breaking the CO bond to make an ester, right? Fischer esterification is an example of that. But you can also break there are a number of pages about Fischer esterification here, and we've already gone through that. So you know, it's going to the tetrahedral intermediate and back again, so we've done that. But if we go over several pages here to here, this we've already, on page 848 here, we've already done this where a carboxylate can be a nucleophile in an SN2 reaction to put the R group on to give an ester. Give an example of that. A more exotic case is to use what's called diazomethane. This is not nice stuff. It's quite toxic and a powerful explosive. It's a gas. So when people make it, they make it in glass that they're sure doesn't have any sharp edges or scratches on it, because those can make it detonate. So this is not something you're going to use all the time. But its virtue is that it gives a really, really high yield in conversion of an acid to a methyl ester. The reason is that the acid protonates the carbon of diazomethane to make a methyl group when it gets protonated that has a fabulous leaving group on it, N2. Right? So it's a cation when you protonate it here, and it loses N2. So this is a really, really high yield reaction. So a synthetic chemist who's put his life, or at least 2 years of his life, into making some very complicated product, and he's got a carboxylic acid, and he wants in the last step or a late step with this precious stuff to get ester in the highest possible yield, he might use this reagent. So those are reactions where you break, as shown in red on the slide, the OH bond to make an ester, rather than things like Fischer esterification, where you break the CO bond. So then, if we go to 17.7 B, D, and E, these are cases where you break the other bond. And the question is then, how to make the OH into a leaving group? Okay. Now, this first section here, 17.7b, is about formation of amides, which is, of course, very important because that's the bond in proteins. right, in polypeptides. So a reagent that's commonly used for that is called DCC. Have any of you ever used that? I wouldn't be surprised. It's very commonly used for this purpose. So the trick of DCC is that it's like CO2, except it's got nitrogen with an alkyl group instead of oxygens here. So a nucleophile can add to the carbon. So here down at the bottom of the page we have the nucleophile, carboxylate, adding to that central carbon. And it's been helped in that effort by first protonating the nitrogen, right, to make this still a lower LUMO. Okay, so that comes in, and now you have this. And this, as it says here, is a better leaving group. So we changed OH into this thing, which is a much better leaving group. Of course, it's also considerably bigger than OH. So in terms of this green concept of atom economy, this isn't so great that you're generating all this junk when it operates as a leaving group. So then here, the amine nitrogen attacks the carbonyl, and this leaving group then leaves over here. So you got this plus this product, which then you got to get rid of. So remember, the very first desideratum of the big pharma companies was a way to make amides in a more atom economical way. They don't want to have to do it this way to generate a lot of product there. Now, the general idea in this activating OHs is you make OH into a better leaving group, as here. There are lots of different anionic leaving groups you could imagine putting on in place of OH. And we've already talked about many of those ideas in the context of alcohols making the OH into a leaving group. But the general idea is that there's sort of a rough hierarchy of things that you can say, take the OH, make it into something that's a really, really good leaving group. You can attack that on the carbonyl with some nucleophile, make the tetrahedral intermediate, the leaving group that you put on leaves, and now you have the new one. But there's sort of a hierarchy. You can go down, make it a nucleophile that's not quite as good a leaving group, and then a nucleophile that's still worse as a leaving group, and then a nucleophile that's still worse as a leaving group. So the idea is to make an energetic molecule, something with a good leaving group at the beginning, and then you can make lower things on the echelon by having, so you have the leaving group there, yours adds to give the tetrahedral intermediate, and then a leaving group leaves, either that leaving group or the one you just put on. So obviously you have to keep going down, down, down in the ability of the leaving groups to leave. So there are lots of examples here, and you can look at them yourself. So an acid chloride, for example, here in 17.7D. And so you can use thionyl chloride, same thing you use for an alcohol, to convert the OH into a chloride, which is then obviously a very good leaving group, just as it was in the case of alcohols. Or you can use not only SOCl2, you can also use PCl5 here, or PCl3. So here they got 93% yield of that acid chloride. There are examples here and so on. Then a nucleophile can displace the chloride. So this is not, for example, in this case, it's the acid chloride can be displaced by an alcohol to give an ester, by an amine to give an amide. It can be replaced by water to go back to the carboxylic acid. It can be replaced by hydride. Right? Now, the hydride's a little more complicated. It goes all the way to the alcohol, and we'll mention that again in just a second. Okay? Now, there are other things you can have, like you can have an anhydride as a leaving group. So the carboxylate is the leaving group from an anhydride. So there's an example here where carboxylate reacts with an acid chloride, so you have a less good leaving group and a better leaving group. HCl is stronger than acetic acid. Right, so the two go on, give the tetrahedral intermediate here, and chloride comes off, just as we were talking about. But now you have a new leaving group, the carboxylate leaving group, which can be used. So acid anhydrides are often used. Okay, BDE. Yeah, that's that. Okay. Now, we'll come back to that in a while. But this, remember, one of these things on their list for green chemistry was to do better leaving groups, where you're not using things like SOCO2, PCl5, and so on, these more vigorous, harsh reagents. So, wouldn't it be neat if you could form an ester, for example, from an alcohol catalytically, so that you don't need to put a lot of reagent in and get rid of it at the end? So, as I mentioned last time, this fellow David Milstein from Israel gave a talk here a week ago, and I thought it was interesting, so I wanted to share with you some of the stuff he was talking about. He's an inorganic chemist and interested in catalysis, so he's got a catalyst that depends on ruthenium, and it's got this complicated ligand associated with it. But the interesting thing it does is it can add hydrogen simultaneously to the organic part, the ligand at this position, and also to the ruthenium. So it can put these two hydrogens on. Okay? Notice that one of the things that makes it easy to do that is that, or can you see here something that helps make it easy to do that? Something that makes it good to go from the top to the bottom? Matt? Yeah, you generate aromatic stabilization from something that wasn't aromatic. In fact, in this picture taken from his paper, there's something that, if you were being persnickety, you might add here on this nitrogen. What? It needs a positive charge because it's got four valences, right? Okay, but at any rate, and the ruthenium therefore changed its oxidation level as well. But at any rate, hydrogen can come on and hydrogen can come off. Now that fact that hydrogen can come off from this thing with these two hydrogens next to one another is what makes it possible to do this reaction that he's touting as green chemistry, and perhaps for good reason. Okay, so that's green. Okay? Now, so you start with this stuff here, right? And you bring in an alcohol, which shares an electron pair with the ruthenium, right? But now you can aromatize this ring, make a double bond here, taking these electrons to take the proton away from here. Okay, so now you've got this, the new bond to H here, and the oxygen's no longer positive. And I've explicitly written the two hydrogens here that are in that CH2 group. The reason I've written them out explicitly is that one of them, the one that's closer to the ruthenium, gets involved in the next step. The next step is those electrons come in, those move up, and those come down. Okay? We often see this thing where three electron pairs shift in a cycle. Right. So what happens when you do that? What happens to this alcohol? Dre, what do you say? What happens to the alcohol? We're going to take these electrons away, but put these electrons in. What will happen? What will the alcohol be at the end of the day? Dre, can you see? What's it going to be bonded to? What's going to hold it to the rest of this complex if these electrons go up here and these come down? Nothing. So what is the alcohol now? It's an aldehyde. It's become oxidized. Alcohol became aldehyde. Okay, but this hydrogen went on the ruthenium. Right? So here's what happened. Right, so the hydrogen is now bonded to the ruthenium, and we've got the alcohol. So we oxidize the alcohol this way. Yeah.
Do you still call it an alcohol even if there's no H on the O when you started with it?
Well, I mean, we started with an alcohol, and now we've got the aldehyde, right? It was an alcohol that came in. So alcohol has become aldehyde here. But do you notice what this stuff is, what's left here? Does that look familiar? right? So it's here. It can lose hydrogen, cycle again. It's a catalyst, right? Which removes H2 from the aldehyde. Okay? So another oxidation involving removal of an H from the aldehyde that we just made and one from another alcohol, together with coupling of this carbon to this oxygen, which is catalyzed by the same complex, and I don't know the details of that, so I'm not showing it to you. I mean, I could imagine it, but anyhow, that completes taking two molecules of alcohol and making from it an ester and two molecules of hydrogen. Right? So instead of making this noxious stuff, this thing is, these noxious byproducts from oxidation and so on. Here you've got, you're generating hydrogen, which in principle could be used as a fuel, people might say. Now, how practical is that, using that stuff as a fuel? That's sort of interesting. So, and there's no other activation required. This is just catalytic. Okay? So this is something that was motivated by the interest in green chemistry. Now, here's the table from his paper showing that this is a pretty good catalyst, at least. So it can take butanol or hexanol or benzyl alcohol. It's done at over 100 degrees for a certain number of hours. It high conversion. And the yield of ester is 90 to 99%. And very little aldehyde escapes, right? Remember, the aldehyde was an intermediate. But almost all of it gets converted to ester. He used 100 times as much alcohol as catalyst in this reaction to do this. But it's interesting to look, in terms of this hydrogen byproduct, at the thermochemistry of this. And I did this because there are very good data on the heat of formation of ethanol, and especially the heat of formation of this ester, the product from doing this reaction, if you used ethanol rather than these others. So we could look at the heat of formation. The heat of formation of ethanol is -66.1 plus or minus 0.5, and two ethanols enter in, so that's the heat of formation of the starting material. Now, the heat of formation of the product. The ethyl acetate has this heat of formation, measured very accurately, in fact, by Professor Weiberg and his graduate students. I was interested to see when I looked it up on the National Institute of Science and Technology website. Okay, so the products have this heat of formation, but there's also hydrogen. What's the heat of formation of hydrogen? Where do you look that up? This is, in fact, a trick question. Yeah? It's zero. That's the standard state of hydrogen, is one atmosphere of hydrogen gas. Okay, so it's zero. So we add these up, and what do you see? That it's 17.4 kilocalories per mole uphill. Right? The starting material is more stable than the product. Right? So how can you possibly do this catalytically? Yeah. Pardon me? There's an entropy advantage, because you get three molecules at the end when you start with two. Right? So that'll give you some statistical advantage. Right? But 17.4 kilocalories is a lot of energy. Right? If we plug that into our to the equilibrium constant, and notice the temperature is not room temperature, it's operated at, say, 150, is about 3/2 of room temperature. Right? Room temperature is about 300, so 150 more than that is 3/2 of room temperature. So when we plug it into 10^-3/4, the temperature denominator is now bigger. So it turns out to be 10^-1/2 of 17.4. So it's 10^-9 is the equilibrium constant for this reaction, plus a little correction for the fact that you're getting three molecules for two. Okay? But what that means is, if we neglect the entropy part, that you'd need that the pressure of H2 would have to be, oops, I got the wrong sign there, has to be less than 10^-9 atmospheres in order to shift the reaction so it would have an equilibrium constant of 1. Okay? Now, is it possible to do that? to get, that's a really low pressure, 10 to the minus 9th atmospheres. Okay? How can you get so little hydrogen there? Well, notice what they did is they either flowed argon through the thing to take the hydrogen gas out or refluxed it. So I get what works, works. I believe he's a good chemist and that he gets a 90% catalytic yield on this, right? But what impresses me here is that you get such a very low pressure of hydrogen. You'd think there'd be a little bit left even if you're boiling the stuff, but there's enough to make this reaction go, evidently. So I think that's an interesting lesson. Okay. And this is another paper from a year or two ago by the same research group, using a very closely related catalyst to do amines as well. So he starts with an alcohol and ammonia and gets an amine or an imine. That's the remember, you get an aldehyde maybe on the way. Aldehydes react with amines to give imines. Right, we did that in the carbonyl chapter. So you get both of these, and here are yields on a whole bunch of these things. And incidentally, another good lesson here with respect to yield is the yield of products were analyzed by gas chromatography. So you take the reaction product and inject it into a GC and see how big the peak is for your stuff. That's different from actually what you can put in a bottle and sell to your neighbor. Right? Just because it's there doesn't mean you can get it out. So he also, in some of these cases, has values in parentheses. And it says the yield in parentheses represents the yield of isolated product. So if you're trying to plan some synthesis and want one procedure or another, which one's good to use, it's important to look in the footnotes and see if what they're saying is a GC determined yield or something they were actually able to isolate, because as you know from some of the stuff we've said earlier, it's not always trivial to isolate things. Okay, but he does not only amines is he able to do, but also he's made, as you see, imines, amides he's been able to do, and so on. So it's interesting. Whether this turns out to be practical in the long run, I don't know. That as a way of producing hydrogen to put in the fuel cell of your car, it doesn't look very good to me, because it has to be so very, very dilute in order for the reaction to go. So somehow you have to concentrate it again to make it useful. So that seems to me not to be such a big selling point, but it is clean, because if you can use a catalyst rather than using one of these big reagents to do these things. Okay. Now, with respect to green chemistry, we looked at this very green reaction last semester. Remember what was special about benzaldehyde? If you turn the bottle upside down, you saw that actually it was mostly benzoic acid. So benzaldehyde got oxidized to an acid. What was the oxidizing agent? We just looked at a bunch of oxidizing agents. Permanganate, chromate, and so on. What's the oxidizing agent here? O2. Right? There's a clean oxidizing agent. Right? So that oil of bitter almonds was converted into benzoic acid by O2. So there's a clean green example. Okay, now let's just... I was looking back and I couldn't find where we had talked about the mechanism of that. Did we talk much about the mechanism of how benzaldehyde goes to benzoic acid? I think not. And at any rate, even if we did, you haven't lit up, so let's assume it's worth doing again. Okay, so benzaldehyde . What theory derived from the work of Liebig and Wöhler on benzaldehyde? Radical theory. So remarkably enough, this is a free radical reaction. So some free radical, I'll just call it X, and we'll see soon what it is, takes the hydrogen away. So this is a pretty good radical here. Remember, I'm drawing single electron curved arrows. It's fancy. So now we've got this free radical. Okay? But it's in the presence of oxygen. Oxygen itself has two singly occupied molecular orbitals. Right? So O2 can react here. And we got this. But this is the X dot. Right? So it pulls off the H and becomes benzoic acid, but not normal benzoic acid, perbenzoic acid. But perbenzoic acid can add to benzaldehyde. That is, it's acidic, so H plus can go up here, and then the anion can go on here. So we get this. Okay? And what happens next? Can you see? What's the weak bond? OO. We're going to break the OO bond. Right? And the way we do it is to have some base. Doesn't have to be a strong base. Take the hydrogen. Oh, wait a second. What am I doing? Oh, I'm taking the wrong hydrogen. Take this hydrogen. It's true that the base would first take this hydrogen, but sometimes it would take this hydrogen. When it takes this one, it just puts it back on again. Okay, but when it takes this one, this leaving group leaves, right? And the product is what? The product at the top, I'll write phenyl instead of writing the ring out again. We generated CO double bond here and benzoate down here. So two molecules of benzoic acid. Right? So aldehyde reacts with oxygen to make a single molecule of oxygen to make two molecules of benzoic acid. So that's the air oxidation of benzaldehyde. That's a very clean green way to do the thing. And this is related to a reaction that we'll see next lecture in section 18.12a. Now just quickly at the end here, look at 17.7f, which is where we are here. So we react with R minus, with R minus, the alkyl lithium. Of course, it's a strong base, it'll take off the proton, right? But, or actually, here's the mechanism up on the next page. This is page 857. Okay, it takes off the proton. So you have an anion. Remarkably enough, the anion, the R minus, is sufficiently nucleophilic to attack the anion. So you can put a second, the new R. This R was there originally. Now there's a new R that's gone on. Right? Now, so that the reaction then stops there. But if you, when you add acid, you make a diol, a gem diol, which loses water and gives a ketone. All right? Good. So you can make an acid into a ketone by reacting with alkyl lithium. Or on the next page here, you can use hydride instead of R minus, right? In this case, you don't get what you might have expected, an aldehyde, you get an alcohol. And the reason is that the aluminum is able to associate with this oxygen enough that it can eliminate, so that the instead of stopping at the O-, as it did when we added the R, this one loses that group and generates the aldehyde, while you still have lithium aluminum hydride there. So now the aldehyde gets reduced again and goes all the way to the alcohol. So as I said here, the question is, do you stop at the C double bond O, or does it go on? In one case it stopped in the alkyl lithium. In the lithium aluminum hydride case, it went on all the way to the alcohol. And there's one more topic in this chapter, but it's time to stop, and we'll do that next time when we go on to chapter 18. Okay.